Audrey. Two women brought together by circumstance.
I'm here about your son.
Nobody here knows I got a son who's one of them. I wouldn't be able to show my face.
He's gonna die!
Two women sharing tragedy.
Yes.
Is he really gonna die?
And facing the truth about themselves.
I haven't seen him in 11 years. He was 17 when they kicked him out.
Two very different women.
I feel like I'm a dynasty.
With so much in common.
You got a boyfriend? No.
Welcome to Bad Gay Movies. I am your host, Bill Antoniou. Today we will be talking about the film Our Sons by John Erman, and I could not talk about the great ladies of yesteryear if I didn't have, returning to the show, one of my favorite people, one of my favorite guests to have on the show, my favorite conversation on Instagram. He is a super talented actor, a gorgeously voiced singer. He keeps the memories of every dead diva alive on the web, and we're so grateful to him. And without further ado, the wonderful James Gibson Bray. Hello, James.
Hi, Bill. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining me again. James, we are talking about a TV movie from the early 90s called Our Sons today. You watched it.
I watched it. I survived it. I walked out of watching this movie just singing I Could Have Danced All Night.
Do you know, I watched this a couple times because, you know, we had to change the date and the dates were far enough that I didn't trust myself to remember it that well. So I watched it a second time for today, and I am gonna just admit that I really like this movie.
I don't hate it. It's not that bad.
Well, I mean, what's bad about it is just the fact that it is the same as every other TV movie, other network TV movie from the early 90s, which is that, you know, it's made to order, basically, which is that it's cut to the commercial breaks. It's pretty daring in subject matter for network TV at the time, but it's not daring in its style in any way.
No.
It's not particularly deeply dramatic. But within the limitations of what it's working with, I think it actually accomplishes quite a bit and also shows off these ladies to great advantage.
I agree. I have to say, I mean, as you said in your introduction, I love a dame of yesteryear. Yeah. Of course, I'm referring to Dame Anne Margaret. Oh, wait. Yeah. I thought they were both excellent. I especially thought Anne Margaret was really great. Julie definitely playing out of her comfort zone. You can kind of tell, but it is kind of fun to see her in the environment that she was in for so long because she lived in California for so long.
Yeah.
But it is funny to see the juxtaposition with someone like Anne Margaret who should be so at home in it and who strangely seems kind of out of place, but
well, because she's the one playing much more of a character that veers on caricature, because that's not who she is. Anne Margaret is not a trashy Southern gal from Fayetteville.
No.
While Julie Andrews is playing the lady we think of her as, except that in this movie she's a businesswoman. I don't know what kind of business she's in.
Like, is it fashion? Is it sportswear?
Is it just spreadsheets? It's just spreadsheets.
It's a spreadsheet on a tape recorder. It's talking about spreadsheets on a fucking tape recorder.
And the businesswoman special. That's all there is in her job. But Julie is so... I've always loved Julie Andrews. I think she's so much better than people give her credit for, because she's so rock solid and she's so classy without it ever seeming lofty or snobby.
My favorite movie is Victor Victoria. I love Julie Andrews so much.
Yeah, she gets away with a lot in that movie, considering I can't see how anyone in the world would ever believe that she was, successfully passing as a man.
Well,
but
you know.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, because she's so great. And also always comes across as intelligent in a really commanding and sympathetic way.
Yeah.
And I like, one thing I like about this movie is the fact that she's kind of the surprise, because we expect Anne Margaret to go on this journey from being intolerant to softening a bit by the end. But the part that's, and that threatens to be a very classist tale, you know, that the upper middle class woman is so much more accepting than the trashy Southern gal. But it turns out that Julie also has things to work out as well.
And,
you know, and she had flat out admits by the end, like, I did have a problem with this. I was pretending to be okay with it. And I love that scene where she says, you know, if my son was dating a woman, I'd know everything about her within an hour. And I know nothing about my son's boyfriend.
I really liked that, because I remember Julie talking about this briefly in her memoir, which to be honest, I was a little disappointed by, but that's a longer conversation. I do remember her trying to, from what I recall, trying to really be as honest as possible about the flaws of the character and about and of wanting to be wanting to be realistic as possible in this portrayal for the sake of the television audience watching. So I did appreciate that, and it's still something that I think you can still see. You know, I don't think a lot of people would acknowledge that, but I do think that there are still lots of gay boys who get thrown out of homes and gay boys don't. But it's like you still. I mean, I still see it. I still meet people who've had similar scenarios where, you know, they're okay with it until they're
right.
not. You know?
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I think there is a timelessness to this movie, even though, again, in its form, it is quite of its time, and you know, really takes me back to the kind of movies I would be watching on a Friday night when I had nothing else to do, which for most of my teen years was the case, because I would have been about 14 when this came out, although I never saw it before we watched it for this show. It's inspired by an Emmy-winning documentary called Too Little Too Late by Mickey Dickoff, which I couldn't find much about, but I do believe it is about families coming to terms with their loved ones having AIDS. And in a lot of cases, as was often the case at the time, people finding out that their children were gay or lesbian because of the fact that they had AIDS, probably gay more often than lesbian, but and it's directed by John Erman, who has a really strong television career for most of his career. He died in 2021. He was born in 1935. His career goes back to the Father of the Bride TV show in the 60s.
Oh my God, that's crazy.
He directed The Streetcar with Treat Williams and Anne Margaret.
Which makes sense, because it's definitely there are Blanche DuBois moments peppered throughout.
Yeah, and he directed Roots, and he directed the Scarlet miniseries, which was the sequel to Gone with the Wind.
Oh yes, the much acclaimed sequel to Gone with the Wind.
God, it's so cheap looking. I remember when that played on TV, and my piano teacher was like, "What bargain basement did they find those costumes at?" And one of his rare features was the movie Stella with Bette Midler and John Goodman in 1990 that I cried so much at that I peed my pants on the way home. Which is also a film that my dear friend Elva Mae Hoover is in. She has
one scene. Cool.
Yeah, she got to do a scene with Bette Midler and told me a lot of nice stories about that. Most significantly, though, John Erman directed a TV movie in the mid-80s called An Early Frost, which is one of the first major projects to deal with AIDS. It's a movie where Aidan Quinn comes out to his parents, telling them that he has AIDS, co-starring Jenna Rollins and Ben Gazzara. And it's another one where it's clearly of its time, like they're treating the subject with kid gloves. He doesn't even get into the same frame with his boyfriend in that movie, let alone clutch him as happens in this film where they actually hug.
Sort of hug. Yeah. It's very awkward.
Yeah. But it's actually a really good movie. It's actually quite touching. And, you know, I know that it seems quaint now to look back on these movies that are about AIDS and yet are never about the person who is dying of AIDS. They're always about the straight people, basically. But on the other hand, I think that people needed to be educated about this, and why not tell a story from the point of view of the person who needs to learn?
And it's definitely meeting people where they're at, which I do appreciate, because there's no way it would have been produced had it been primarily about that. Yeah. And B, I don't think that it is about family. This movie really is about family, about specifically mothers and sons, but family more generally. And I do think it accomplished what it was trying to, like you said, for the most part, decently well. I do wonder how much money the Little Rock Board of Tourism paid this producer to have Little Rock mentioned every 5 minutes.
Yes, yeah.
You went to Little Rock? Oh, we have to go to Little Rock. Little Rock, oh.
Yes, and also, like, I mean, Little Rock is a long flight from San Diego. It's it's a 3-hour drive to Fayetteville from Little Rock. And how many pit stops do those ladies need?
They're going to every podunk pit stop. It's crazy.
It's this weird plot point that she refuses to get on a puddle jumper. She will fly to San Diego, but she won't get on a smaller plane to fly Fayetteville to Little Rock. So she has to drive.
And then she says, "Oh, I bu- my you know my knee got bummed by the."
That's a long monologue about that.
I know. And then she's wearing these platform heels for the entire movie. I'm thinking, what's happening here?
Like, but also, like, all you needed was for there to be no flights available, because there's no way that Fayetteville to Little Rock happens 17 times a day.
Yeah,
all you needed was for there to say, there's a storm a-coming, we have to drive. Really? There's no flight. Like, that's all you needed. I did not need this deep backstory of her getting into a shaky plane situation that made her never want to get on a tiny plane ever again.
It didn't try. It just did not. Especially for someone like that character who's obviously seen some things and is a tough broad. I think the vulnerability of the weakness and the vulnerability had to be about her son and about that situation. But I guess they kind of wanted to mirror it in some other way to show her soft or you know, her vulnerability.
Yeah. But we also had the thing of her, the thing that really matters, which is that her caring so much what people think. Like, she can't even have this rich lady show up in a limo without worrying about what the neighbors are going to say, because then they're going to ask, and then they're going to find out that it's about her son, and then they're going to find out her son. You know, like, that's an interesting conflict that she has. So, like, plane trauma is a bit, I don't know. It's weird. It's like they were like, oh, we need to cut two pages, figure out a way to make this make sense or something.
I know. It's like Margaret meets Amelia Earhart all of a sudden. Like, I don't know. What's going on?
But the other plot setup that it doesn't fully make sense to me, and I think that there's a lot about this movie that's very well written. The scenes between the two ladies are very, very well written. I love a lot of the dialogue. I believe it's a straight man writing this film. It's William Hanley who wrote the script, who wrote, I don't know if you've ever seen the TV movie Little Gloria Happy at Last, which is about Gloria Vanderbilt's, the custody over Gloria Vanderbilt, and Angela Lansbury's in it.
I know what it is. I haven't seen it, but obviously I'm a big Angie fan.
I remember watching at least part of it, because it was one of those like two-part, three-part miniseries, and I remember watching at least one part. So he was a successful writer as well. And he was married twice, so I'm assuming he wasn't gay, because gay men marry women, but usually it's only straight men who leave
them. It's a Carol Chan situation.
And I was looking this up because he has lines like Jelko Ivanek saying, you know, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore. And I'm like, is that something gay men actually say, or is that something straight guys think gay men actually say?
And that's the thing, that I really felt it was like someone took the gay characters out of a cereal box and thought, oh, these will work, you know, like it didn't really.
Yes, except the rest of the time he's always quoting things like Edward G. Robinson and James Cagney. And I'm like,
I know he's quoting Edward G. Like, what is this? Like,
gay men who quote old movies don't quote gangster guys in gangster movies. It's Betty Davis or nothing, guys.
But, literally, give me at least Olivia de Havilland, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And then also, before I get to my main point, the watercolors in Julie's bedroom in her opening scene. Was that filmed in her beach house from That's Life?
Which is her real house.
Yeah, I wondered, because it's like the same decor.
I think, and that's the thing, is that I couldn't find anything definitively. I should have gone back and looked at her memoir again, but I do have I really thought, is this just Julie Andrews and Blake Edwards' house? Is this...
Yeah. Yeah. Did she film a lot in her own home? I don't know.
I mean, I know he did, so yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. But the setup of the story, basically, her son is a very young Hugh Grant, the most handsome man with the biggest head in the entire world.
who somehow played every gay character for about 3 or 4 years on screen.
Well, because who did we want to make out with more? I mean, he was so cute, with so much hair, and... also can't do accents. I'm going to say this. I think he's one of the most talented men in the entire world, and he cannot do accents.
And why is he American and she's British? Makes no sense.
I didn't get that either. I'm like, we didn't need him. Like, he could have just spoken, I don't know. There could have been another reason why they lived in California. It didn't have to be that she had him in the States.
Yeah.
His accent isn't bad, I should say. I just don't buy it. And that might just be because I am so familiar with him, you know, watching this many years later. Mm-hmm. Although, had I watched it at the time it came out, I think I still would have known who he was, because I'm pretty... No, I didn't see Morris until a couple of years after that, which is when I first discovered him, and I thought he was so cute. And then it's only a few years after that, The Four Weddings and Funeral comes out, and he becomes, you know, a mega star.
Yeah.
I don't know if gay men wore such oversized shirts or pleated pants.
To be honest, I know he was like, sure he's cute. Sure he's got the hair. He's got the look. He's got the, you know, the bedroom eyes. I've never been a huge Hugh Grant fan. And I don't buy him. I don't think he passes. I don't buy it. Like, I didn't worry
about it one way or the other. I mean, Aidan Quinn didn't really pass either, but it's just like, this was casting of the time, which is that you want to veer towards something that is not going to alienate straight audiences. So they want him to gay and they have to be handsome and they want, you know, you want someone who's. And then his job apparently is like, is that his job, being a pianist at a?
Is he like Michael Feinstein? Like, I don't like he, it's just this odd kind of, works at a piano bar that has like 100 seats in it or something like that. And I don't know.
Or everyone shuts up to listen to him play, where he plays in sensible sweaters and Eddie Bauer pants. I mean,
oh my God. It's like, this isn't San Diego. This is the fucking Hamptons, you know? Like it's wacky.
He gives off the vibe of like, he gives off the vibe to me of he plays when he feels like it, when he shows up, because it's fun. I couldn't tell if it was like his job.
And it's like, is he playing classical piano? Is he playing jazz piano? Is this a jazz bar? Is this a bar where people happen to be?
It's easy listening jazz.
Oh God, kill me.
But to finally get to my point, he wants to tell his partner's mother that her son is dying, even though his partner has not seen his mother in years because she kicked him out when he told her he was gay. And then he asks his mom to go because he tries to call her. Anne Margaret doesn't pick up the phone, so he plays a sonata. And then he realizes he can't do it. And he's like, can you please go? The justification for that feels murky to me, the way he sort of moves his mother into going. It would make much more sense if she, because we already are going to establish that she's in denial. She's in denial about the fact that she's not as okay with her son's being gay, Julie Andrews is, as he says she is. And one of the things people do when they're in denial is overdo something else. And so it would make more sense if she was a pushy mother who, even though, because she's so busy, she has put calling him on a list of things to do. So how easy is it for her to go there? So wouldn't it make more sense if she was like a bit psycho, who is overly involved in her son's life. And she's like, no, you don't do it. I'll tell her. You don't have to do it. I'll tell her. And that kind of bugs him. And that also leads to conflict. Like, wouldn't that be more cogent plot-wise?
It just like out of nowhere, suddenly she's so agreeable. And she's just sitting at home one night and he calls her up and says, I need you to do this.
Yeah.
They meet and then he asks her the next day or something. It's all too much too fast. And we see how she acts in her professional life.
Yeah.
And it's with a kind of an arrogance that I just don't believe wouldn't cross over with her son.
That would also make more sense if her arrogance translated into her also butting in even.
Yeah, totally.
Which is that he's like, no, I'm going to call her. Don't worry. But it's like, no, I'm going to call her. Better yet, I'm going to go get her and I'm going to drag her back. Because one of the ways that people will often avoid admitting their difficulty with emotional intimacy is to overdo something that they do physically, which is, in her case, you know, that she would overdo this activity to help hide the fact that she's actually really uncomfortable thinking about what her son and his boyfriend do, even though she let him design her house.
I know. Oh, Jesus. And what a house. Honestly, what a house.
Can you have already designed a house by the time, because he's like 27 or something when he dies? Like, can you have
allegedly.
Architect? I don't know. Can you have already designed a house by then? I don't know.
I don't know. If you've drawn enough castles, apparently you can. I don't know.
Yeah. And I love that actor who plays the dying boyfriend, Jelko Ivanek. He is, I guess he's famous for what was the TV show that he was on for a while?
He was on Damages.
Right, that's right.
And wasn't he on House of Cards too? I feel as though
I mean, he shows up as a heavy in a lot of those, especially as he's gotten older and more like a angry lawyer kind of look that he's got.
I was good with everything I've ever seen him in. He always looks as though he might be on the brink of death. Yeah. So it's sunken eyes and the weariness.
Yeah, it's the Eastern European background. You just like, worn out. He has a small part in Hannibal. He's the one that pushes Gary Oldman into the pit of feral pigs or whatever when Anthony Hopkins says, push him in. You can say I did it.
Oh, yes.
And then I first knew him because he also plays a gay character in the movie Mass Appeal with Jack Lemmon from the mid-80s.
Oh, yeah, I know that movie.
Yeah, when he was still, like, young and cute. And he's really good in that as well. He's actually very good in that. That's based on a play. So I appreciated seeing him in this. Very good makeup by, I believe it's by Academy Award winner Michelle Burke. On him. Also, in the 80s, and I don't mean to say this just because I've lived through COVID, but in the 80s, if you're going into the full-blown AIDS ward, aren't you going to put a mask on to...
Well, see, this is the thing, is that I wasn't sure what period have they decided this is in, especially considering, like, we're at a stage where he has not been tested, and, like, especially with Anne Margaret's character, even though she watches the news, and to be honest with Julie Andrews, too, I don't believe that they wouldn't have some kind of PPE of some sort.
Yeah. It covers faces and it makes for bad drama, and that's maybe why. But
I mean, probably. Yeah. It is television.
91 is a long time after it has become common knowledge, because I feel like, you know, 85 is when it becomes a national talking point with the death of Rock Hudson.
Yeah.
And this is certainly my memory of it. By 1991, we all knew the facts, capital F. Like, we knew how you got it. We knew that you didn't get it from toilet seats or from talking to people, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And so that it was only the people who are, like, dedicated to their ignorance who are still going to have feelings about it. And of course, that's where the plot threatens to be a bit classist, in the fact that it's like the trashy southern town where people still have these really backwards ideas about this sort of thing. But like I said, I think it balances it out with Julie's story anyway. So I think it's supposed to take place at the time that the movie is made, depending on how long it took to get made.
So in that case, it makes more sense, but it's not, they don't get specific about when.
Because I think, I mean, the purpose of wearing PPE in the ward is to protect the patient. It's not about protecting the visitors, right?
Yeah, of course.
So you don't want to just be bringing everything in.
They wouldn't give him any of those fucking chocolates, though.
Oh my God, Hugh Grant eats all of those chocolates. I was like, Jesus, buddy, I know you're cute, but like those parachute pants aren't going to be that forgiving after a little while.
Also, like, he's dying. Give him a chocolate.
No, he eats them all. Yeah. Oh, I love when Julie calls. Tony Roberts is in this movie, most famous as Woody Allen's friend in the 70s movies.
I know.
And he has a small part in this, which she calls, I need a friend. And he says something cute to her. She's like, I need a friend. And it sounds like the Manchurian Candidate. Like, she's like.
And also that he's in the middle of this important business meeting and then does this little fetal position thing with the phone, where he's just like, oh, I have, and he doesn't even say anything. He just turns about, oh, yes. And then meets this woman at any old bar where she's wearing this ridiculous black tracksuit for most of it.
Is it clear that, like, he's her booty call? Is that are they, like, friends with benefits? Is that?
I don't know. So it's not clear to me, because then I thought, okay, is he the business executive that's also gay, that is, like, the bridging point? But I do think that he had proposed to her before, so it wasn't clear.
I think, I mean, the story that I put together in my head is that, like, she's done with marriage, but he's, like, her gentleman companion. He's the one that takes her to functions, and, you know, maybe sometimes they enjoy a quiet evening together. It's the 80s, so it's probably, like, cognacs in front of the fire, you know? Making love.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. To easy listening piano.
And also in this era, we talked about this when we did another TV movie, in this era where, like, getting together for a drink, it's always at, like, a classy bistro with tablecloths. Like, no one goes to pubs or diners. Like that. It's always, like, tablecloths and centerpieces and candlelight, always.
Especially in American pieces.
Yes.
Everything is trying to be as classy as possible.
That plane that she's on when she goes to Little Rock looks like a military plane.
They're not kidding around. Jesus.
Yeah. And it cuts to her in the most comfortable seat, like, God, what, these are the days of flying, with so much headspace. Because, you know, the way that they never accurately show planes correctly when they film them, because there's always too much headspace. Whereas when you get on an actual plane, you can't even stand up in them, or at least I can't. And she's taping herself dictating her notes, like, loud for everyone to hear.
Yeah. Oh, God.
And then her confusion when she gets to Fayetteville and he takes her to the address and she's like, Homettes, when he says they are Homettes.
Oh, the Homettes. And I wrote down, I said, personally, I prefer Harlettes, but But I don't think Jennifer Lewis is in this movie. So
or Katie Seagal.
Or Katie Seagal. It's so, and also like, oh, I thought it would be a condominium, Alila.
Yeah. It's delightful. I mean, and I wish that the movie played it up a little more, because I love the fact that Anne Margaret always has her number. You know what I mean? Like, she's the one who's upholding the whole, like, the class difference between them. And like, Anne Margaret's just never impressed.
Never.
And then, like, she drives in to find her homette, and these people are crawling over the car like they've never seen like, it's like they're Depression-era children in Annie. Like, they've never seen a car before.
Like, it's the friggin' Wells Fargo wagon in The Music Man. Like,
Yeah, as if they haven't been screwed over by land developers enough times that they've never seen a big car. But anyway.
Of course.
Because it's like, it's a nice trailer park, or whatever it is. I don't think it's trailers. I think it's like prefab homes. But like, it's a nice, for all that it's like, you know, economically oppressed, shall we say. It's also like, you know, there's kids playing and it seems like there's nice neighborhood action. It doesn't seem miserable.
It's completely unremarkable in it. You know, there's nothing, it's not offensive or anything, but you can tell they're really playing up. Oh, now we're in Arkansas, you know, so.
Yeah, and then, like, they have their, you know, this is what we've been waiting for them to square off. These two big-time ladies, you know, award-winning actresses, huge stars, neither of whom have ever really had a really that bad a dip in their career. Like, I know that there was a period where all of Julie Andrews' movies were bombing, but she was still a big deal. Like, no one ever...
Yeah.
And then Anne Margaret, whether it was on stage or on screen or on the small screen, like they're both huge successes all the time.
Yeah.
And they bring all of this sheen with them to this movie. Like, again, I love watching them together when Julie's like, he's going to die, you stupid bitch.
Oh, my God. When Julie Andrews has a close up and gets to call Anne Margaret a stupid bitch.
I know.
And you can just tell Julie was not necessarily particularly thrilled with saying, I mean, maybe she was, I don't know. But
oh no, I think she was. Don't forget, she's famous for having a potty mouth in real life. She's got a very wicked sense of humor. I mean, this is something that Blake loved about her when he met her.
Oh, that is true. That is true. Yeah. But what I did, I love just how it was just like extreme close up shot.
Totally. Yeah.
And then Anne Margaret being rather nonplussed by the whole thing, which
because I mean, Julie's, a lot of what drove Julie with her career choices was to break apart this image of her as like the prim nanny, you know, because of her two most famous roles. And she could never really quite break away from it because she still had that way of speaking, you know, like people don't realize that Julie Andrews is like, her background was like as a music hall performer. You know, she didn't come from
money.
She's like a Juilliard-trained theater actress or anything like that.
And she just had this, as she said, she had this freakish voice. And her father, like, her stepfather, I think, was a music teacher. Someone in her family was a music teacher. They performed in music hall, which is, you know, the vaudeville of the UK. And it was pretty destitute.
Has the third part of her autobiography come out?
No, I think it's coming out either this year or next year. I know that it's soon, but I'm really looking forward to that. Also, about Tony Roberts, what's interesting is that after this movie, they starred on stage in Victor Victoria together.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so he played the Robert Preston part on Broadway later. So it's funny, like, obviously not a romantic partnership, but I kind of thought, oh, okay, so that's where they met, because it was so insular. Famously, in that production, the best part about that was Blake Edwards having never directed a show on stage before, his way of directing was to film the rehearsals and then go home and edit them. And that's how he would.
Amazing.
Can't make this stuff up.
I do wish I had seen it, though. For all that I've heard about that production, I do wish I'd seen it. I know that it's been filmed. I think you can watch like a filmed version of it.
I think it was filmed for Japanese TV. That's what I remember.
And my friend served Raquel Welch at a cafe around the time she was taking over the role. And boy, did he have stories about that. Tony Roberts also, he published an autobiography a few years ago with a very small publisher. And he said that a bigger publisher was interested, but they would only publish it if he did a chapter solely on Woody and Sun Yi. And he's like, no, because I have nothing to say about it. And so they turned him down. Yeah, but it's typical, though. It's typical of a lot of the celebrity cases of these sort of salacious scandals, which is that, like, we all have a lot of principles about what we say about it, but the truth is we're all spectators. Like, it's all about mining people for salacious stories. I know that Alison Arngrim, who played Nellie Olson, she talked about how there were a lot of, when she was promoting her book, and I guess her one-woman show, there were a lot of talk shows that only wanted her to have her on if she had stories to tell about Michael Landon molesting her. And she's like, no, I don't. And so they weren't interested, you know. And it's just like, are we trying to make a better world, or are we all just going to the air show hoping that we're there on the day that the airplane crashes?
Oh, well, we know the answer. I mean, God yeah. knows.
But anyway, but I didn't read Julie's two autobiographies. The ones that are out, I listened to them, and I found that there wasn't actually enough to justify it being split up. I feel like it could be one book.
And the one about her Hollywood years, I was just so looking forward to it because I, like you, I am such a fan.
Yeah.
And I grew up watching the Nanny movies. And yeah. It felt a bit like a diary. And then we went to Switzerland. And then
yeah, because it's not really enough about her work. It's mostly about the fact that her husband kept her from working for a great deal of her career.
Yeah.
Which she doesn't seem to have regrets about. I know that he sounds like he was a real character, but also that she loved him. I mean, like, they really did seem to have
a happy marriage. I love that they met going in and out of psychoanalysis on Sunset
Boulevard. That's,
right. Yeah. That's my favorite.
Yeah. But yeah, I was a bit disappointed, especially with the second book. I thought we could have condensed this. But again, I think Julie's the best. I hope we still have her for a long time, even though I get the impression that she's done with public life. You know, like, she doesn't appear at anything anymore.
Not really. I know she lives near New York City now. I know she lives in like the near Long Island, I think.
Yeah.
Somewhere.
And like, maybe if she puts out the next book, we'll see her show up to promote it. But even that, I don't know. I mean, the last time I even saw her being on camera was her promoting the last volume.
Yeah,
but she doesn't act. She hasn't acted in years, and most of the acting work she's done for the last however many years was solely voice work. So,
yeah,
and I feel like she might be done that too because she's almost 90 years old. You know, like
she's
up there. So anyway, but I think she's incredible. But moving on, I do love her. I do love her playing a character who is very much the way we assume she is, and then we find out the subtle gradations under it. It's also funny when she asks if the car has air conditioning.
Oh, my God.
And also interesting, she doesn't like the word queer. I like that that's like an insult at this time in culture.
And I like that is, and see, that's the, when I talk to gay men from who were coming up, who were my age at that time, that is interesting to hear because it is why they prefer the separation and why they may talk about being in the queer community, but they prefer to identify their own way.
Yeah.
It is. I love hearing Julie Andrews say any kind of slurry word because it just sounds so delicious.
I know. It's so great. I know. Like when she calls her a bitch. And I love their dynamic. I love that, like, it's not simply that one of them is liberal and the other one is intolerant. Mm-hmm. Like, there is always an undercurrent of sass to everything Anne Margaret says whenever she's talking to her. Like, when and she doesn't give, you know, like when she's painting her nails on the airplane, she's always doing something very like pseudo Dolly Parton. You know, it's like painting her nail.
So wig is complete Dolly Parton meets like designing women. Like, it's
yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's so crazy too when you see her with her own hair, and like, that's more the Anne Margaret that you know, that we know and love. But yeah, and when she's on the plane, she's painting her nails, and she's like, it's just different, you know. When she says that, like, when Julie's like, you know, there's some straight couples who get up to some pretty crazy shit.
Yeah,
you know, that it's not just gay people who are quote unquote immoral. And Margaret's like, yeah, but it's different. And she's like, why is it different? It just is, you know. Like, I don't make the rules. Like, the way she's just so, fuck it, I don't care.
Yeah.
I also love, at the end, there's this also another weird plot thing of her, like, deciding to leave and then changing her mind, which means that her suitcase is still flying back to Little Rock, but she's decided to stay. She needs to go shopping for clothes.
Yeah.
She drops her off at, like, a discount Kmart, basically, where she buys what appears to be the full Alexis Carrington green suede outfit with the epaulettes. Like, that's what she picks up.
And doesn't she make a Dynasty reference, too? Doesn't she say... Yeah. Oh, I thought this was, this makes me think I'm in Dynasty or something, which I obviously loved. So.
Well, because I also love when she first goes to visit him in the hospital, Julie lends her clothing from her wardrobe, which and Margaret says is too tight on her, which I don't believe for a second. They're both
because she looks so sexy in it. She looks great.
Well, that's the thing. It's tight on her, and it's hysterical that it's like tight in all the right places. Like it's fully voluptuous va-va-voom on her, even though Julie Andrews has been wearing boxy lady businessman suits this entire film. And they both weigh 50 pounds soaking wet. Like there's no way one of them's clothing is tight on the other, except that Julie's probably taller.
Absolutely. But I do love that she still got, like, it's like all Julie stuff, but she still got those, like, woven platform heels that she just wears for the entire film. And all the way through.
I also love how passionate Julie gets every time a drink is mentioned. Like, she's always...
The woman is an alcoholic in this movie.
Or she's just English, because it's always like, you know, do you want a drink? Oh my God, I'd kill for a drink. Like every time someone brings up a drink, it's always just been hours since she had one. And she's like, oh my God, it's the one thing I need today.
What I also love is that she's so prim and proper about the cigarettes. Oh, she needs the I need the window put, you know, I don't want to get hooked again from the secondhand smoke. And then, she's just knocking back the scotches like there's no tomorrow.
So great. She smokes in the hospital. I love when she's just like, can I smoke in here? And I'm like, has anyone ever thought they could even ask if they could smoke in the hospital in years?
Well, apparently, Edmer, and then the nurse questioning her, who looks like a cross between Thelma Ritter and Roseanne Barr.
Yes, totally.
But is totally Earth Mother, you know. Again, very Betty Davis. But
yeah, she says, has someone been smoking in here? And like, that's how you know it's TV, because in real life, you walk into a room immediately and you know someone's been smoking in there.
And she's also like smoking in the corner, and you're in there. It's absurd. Yeah, but
it's so funny. But what a huge centerpiece that scene is. Her squaring off with her son. That scene is so good. It is so good.
When she's like, well, you brought it on yourself.
Yeah. She goes through all the motions. And then even when they do get tender, when she talks about, I remember how you used to draw and look how you're drawing, where it took you and all that stuff. It's all very underplayed. And as a result, it's very moving. Yeah.
What I love about Anne Margaret, and I know that because she's done so much TV and film work, people who are fans of hers know this, but I think especially for younger people who have seen some of her stuff, or especially like her earlier film where she's dancing around the screen.
Yeah.
I really think Anne Margaret, even though she had a good career, is an underrated dramatic actor.
I fully agree.
And like, completely underrated. And it's funny you bring up Streetcar, because she's so good in that. It's a very strong performance. It's a TV movie of Streetcar, so with that, it's going to, you know, it's...
But
it's,
was it done... Did she do it on stage, too? Is it like the Jessica Lange one, where they're filming the stage play?
It's not... They're not filming the stage play. I don't remember. I wouldn't be surprised if she did, but I hope she did, because she's terrific. She really is so good at that.
I think she's underrated because a lot of people who love her only love her for the one thing they know her best from. And I think not a lot of people appreciate the breadth of her accomplishments, given that she was a sex kitten in the 60s, which, by the way, she was really good at. Like, she holds her own against Elvis in Viva Las Vegas, which is one of the most enjoyable bad movies you will ever watch. That movie makes zero sense, and she is an absolute star in it. She also has bodysuits in that movie that give her sideways camel toe. But she is magnificent. She's magnificent. And then spends the 70s as an Academy Award nominated actress twice. Yep. And she's incredible in Carnal Knowledge. It's always like, it's breathy and it's pretty and it's adorable, but there is always something, there's a layer under it of like strength to it. It's not, she's not flimsy in any way.
And you always feel as though she's kind of the woman wronged, you know? Like there's something that's happened to her. And I mean, listen, she survived working with Paul Lynde in the 60s. So that
she also survived that horrible accident, right? Didn't she have to have her whole face reconstructed after she fell off a stage? Like that's terrible. That's super trauma.
Horrible. Yeah.
So yeah, I recently watched her in a magnificent film that I'd never even heard of before called The Return of the Soldier, with her and Glenda Jackson and, Alan Bates and Julie Christie. It's on
Heavy hitters.
You can watch it properly on Hoopla, or Tubi, I believe.
Great.
Because I did an article on the 1982 Cannes Film Festival competition, and that was in there. And she plays like the Doughty sister-in-law, and it's not Anne Margaret in drag as Doughty. Like, it's a truly masterful, strong performance. It's unjustly forgotten movie because they're all superb in it, and it's really, really, really good. So anyone who's a fan of hers, I particularly enjoyed her performance in that. I thought she was really
good. I'll have to check it out. I don't think I've even heard of that. I love a Glenda movie too, so.
For sure, yeah. And Julie, I mean, I love Julie Christie. So, yeah. And it's a director that I really like who only made, he's another one who had like a very, Alan Bridges, he had a television career.
Oh yeah.
And made a handful of features, including winning the Palme d'Or for The Hireling. And then
this
film. Yeah. And he made that movie, The Shooting Party as well with John Gielgud, which is also a really good movie. Anyway. Oh, Jimmy, I could talk to you about movies, about the ladies. But yeah, that scene is great. Anne Margaret and Jelko Ivanek. And I wish, it's like, oh my God, I wish we could make a play out of this, even though it's like tired subject matter at this point. But I wish we could. Like, it's so good.
What I liked about it too, and I guess this also speaks to the writing and the direction, but I liked that in its understatedness, it also really, because ultimately, and obviously I'm biased, but I do think that even with the very human struggle to accept something like this, when you have deep-seated beliefs, it really didn't shy away from showing her selfishness about all of it. Yeah. And I liked that it didn't try to, it humanized her, but it didn't make her, it didn't justify the behavior. You know,
no, like the big dramatic climax is that she softens, but she doesn't necessarily change.
No,
it's more of a plea for people to just stop worrying so much about all the things they believe so strongly in and to just be kinder to each other, really.
Yes.
She probably will spend the rest of her life thinking, I wish my son wasn't gay because he'd still be alive if he wasn't.
Yeah.
Or, you know, she probably will spend the rest of her life thinking it's an abomination against God, but she also loves him. And, you know, she asks for his body to be brought back home so that she can have him near her. You know, she no longer wants to pretend that he doesn't exist. And like,
yeah.
You know, isn't that good enough? Because now I don't even remember, and I watched it twice. Does she touch him? That's one of the big things, is that she's afraid.
So at the end, she does touch him when she's feeding him that hot chocolate, which she only gets one sip of. What's it with this guy and the chocolate? I don't understand. They won't give him anything enjoyable. He's dying. He's got 2 days left. Like,
I know. I know, and then when he gets to watch a movie before he dies, and it's Till the Clouds Roll By that he's watching.
It is Till the Clouds Roll By, yeah.
Which is one of the worst Judy Garland movies ever. She's only in 2 scenes, and it's public domain, which is why it's being included in this. It's one of those movies where they didn't renew the copyright. But it's
Judy
awful.
Garland, isn't it Van Johnson? Isn't that who she's
And everybody. With? It's one of those movies where MGM trotted out all of the stars to have, like, one number in it.
Even Baby Liza at the end.
No, is she in that one too? She's in The Good Old Summertime.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm mixing them up. That is Van Johnson. Oh, yeah.
That's right. Yes.
I'm a Judy Garland fan.
In The Good Old Summertime is fun. Till the Clouds Roll By is the movie that's like a biopic of Jerome Kern.
Oh, of course. And it has the showboat story in it. Yes.
Yes. I remember. And then Judy sings Look for the Silver Lining and Who. She plays Marilyn Miller is the...
Yeah, Marilyn Miller, the actor. Yeah.
That's right, and she's only in like 2 scenes, and she's pregnant with Liza, actually. That's what it is. When she sings Look for the Silver Lining, and she's behind the countertop, it's because she's pregnant. But it's boring. I've seen it back when I used to watch all Judy Garland movies on a loop, because I was just that gay. It was one of the ones that, I don't know why I watched it so many times, because it was so fucking boring.
I remember seeing it on TCM, and it was a snooze fest.
Yeah. But I know that they chose her for this because they didn't have to pay for it, but still, it's just like, he spent this entire time quoting like Little Caesar and White Heat, even though he's a gay man, and then you show a Judy Garland movie, and you're not even showing the Judy Garland scene.
Right? I know. It's like, why don't you just like keep with the theme and watch the Ten Commandments, you know what I mean? Like,
but the Ten Commandments is gayer than gangster movies because it's got Ann Baxter. Like, I knew a gay man who had Ann Baxter tattooed on his arm, specifically her role in that film. Like, that movie is a full... Cecil B. DeMille provides a lot of inspiration for drag queens the world over.
Oh, please. Yeah.
So, you know, even that would be a more logical choice. But I do have this note, too, that Hugh eats all them chocolates.
It's rude! It's so rude! How dare he?
Oh, yes. Also, Anne Margaret flops into that pool when she goes for a swim at the end.
I was like, is she going to kill herself?
Yeah, she belly flops into the pool.
It's so dramatic. It's full on James Mason walking into the Atlantic and A Star Is Born, or the Pacific rather. It's very drama. And this pool, I'm sorry, why is the pool like steaming hot 24 hours a day?
Yeah.
It's like, it just, none of this tracks. And it's not, it doesn't look like that nice pool. I love how she comes in. Oh, I'd love to take a look in that pool.
She's right, though. All these people in California have pools and they're never using them. She's absolutely right about that.
It is true.
People are always throwing parties around their pools, but they're never actually using the pool.
I can't imagine Julie Andrews swimming in that pool, so it does.
I feel like that's how she keeps herself fit. I don't know. I just wanted to know more about what it is that she did for a living.
Like, I remember in the beginning, there is one scene where there are sketches of women's wear, but it's in the corner of the shot in the back.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
It's something like, I don't know, if you're working out to Jane Fonda, this is what you're wearing, you know? Like, right. I don't know. But
she's the big time because, like, her house is huge. She lives in a Hollywood mansion.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It's like, this is full on Streisand compound. Like, the other thing that's interesting is, I don't know. I do buy it from a dramatic perspective, but I don't quite buy Hugh Grant by the end still not wanting to get tested until the very end. I get it, but I kind of, it was quite a blatant dramatic device.
Although that plot point is the only thing where my thing about her being a nosy, insistent mother, like, actually works and makes sense, which is that he doesn't want to because, you know, it's an understandable fear. It's just like, if I find out it's real, whereas if I have it and I don't know, then I can just go about my life.
And his point about it, you know, if I have it, then I can go about it. And if I don't have it, then I don't need to worry. I mean, especially at that time, obviously it makes sense with the lack of treatment, but
Treatment, and also, like, those were the days where you got tested and you didn't get the results for like 2 weeks after that. So you had the longest 2 weeks of your life waiting to find out the news.
Yeah. Now it's just the longest 5 minutes of your life. But
yeah, which can be a long 5 minutes, but still.
Yeah. But yeah, I will say that the last scene, and I was glad because Julie's not overly emotional as an actor on screen. You know, like she is a bit, she's always poised, you know, for better or for worse. But I liked that she got teary and really let a little of that come through. But I personally found it so uncomfortable with Hugh Grant trying to summon something. I've never found him. It's just not him.
He's not that kind of guy. I mean, he is rather miscast in this movie, as much as I adore him. And I love having this like early career moment from him because I never knew about this movie and I thought I'd seen everything that he did back in the day. But
it felt very uncomfortable and interesting again with this person finally letting herself a little bit of her emotional vulnerability come through, not channeling into something else. And then Hugh Grant looking like, you know, the uncomfortable little kid being hugged by a relative,
Because he's also, his strength is also not vulnerability, you know, like his thing. That's why he's so good at comedy, is that like, putting on the sarcastic air and then the feelings are hidden underneath that, like the insecurity is underneath that. And here he's supposed to play like open-hearted, and that's not really who he is. Mm-hmm. And this is something I love about Julie Andrews. I love her poise, and I love that there's always like layers of strength and sensitivity hidden beneath an underplayed character. This is actually why her performance in Mary Poppins is so much better than that role deserves. And
I agree.
So much more than people realize, is because she's so good at the layers. I don't know that she necessarily needed an Academy Award for it, but I don't regret the choice either. She is really great. And in particular in this role, I mean, she's playing a capital B businesswoman, which means she is succeeding in a world where women are always seen as emotional. And so women who succeed in this capitalist venture usually have to overdo they're seeming like they're not emotionally vulnerable in any way, and they have to put on a mask to keep up with the boys, so to speak. So she's going to be somebody who's very careful about how she allows herself to emote in front of other people.
It is actually, from that perspective, an excellent casting choice in that way, you know, because, and I remember an actor when Julie Andrews did that Sondheim review, putting it together in the 90s off Broadway. That one of the actors saying that she would, you know, she would host tea parties. So it's actually, I think it was probably within a couple years of this film, she would host tea, you know, she would have tea time and all this kind of thing. But he, he always thought that she was quite sad, which I totally buy, which is clear from her writing, that she has this undercurrent of wistfulness and sadness, but that you never quite knew the woman, you know, that there was that.
Yeah. Is it wistful? Is it sadness or is it an undercurrent of stress? You know, this is a woman who was feeding her family from when she was 12 years old. And I wonder, is it that she was always sad or that she always had that, oh my God, I left the gas on kind of stress ticking away at her underneath?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, especially because she grew up during the Blitz. I mean, that makes it makes sense from a...
And her mother was an alcoholic and like she was taking care of the family from a young age. And then she marries Blake Edwards, who is, you know, something of a mess personally. So she's always probably feeling like she has to compensate for his vulnerabilities as well.
Again, it's a good casting choice from that perspective because it's someone who's taking care of everything.
Yeah.
But is not really giving herself permission to be flawed.
Yeah.
Which is also an ego thing though. Because
You
know, when you're doing that, you're saying, well, you're denying it too. I'm not saying Julie Andrews is doing that. God knows I would never insult her. But but it is like, I think she really plays that well.
And I appreciate that the movie ends with Anne-Margaret giving him the drawing and we never get a close-up of the drawing. I thought that was a nice subtle touch.
I agree. I will say, I love that. So we kind of see, like you said, like there's a military jet. There's the, you know, she talks about the plane going down and having her knee injured.
Yeah.
And then at the end, she has a pamphlet for the plane, and it just says Global Airlines. Like, what set decorator fakakta like intern has given her this ridiculous pamphlet?
I don't think that's a pamphlet. I think that's like, remember, that's the envelope that the tickets used to come in when we used to use paper tickets.
Oh, of course. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's just like, excuse me? Like it was very, I loved how ridiculously 90s that was. Yeah. It's also like I don't know what the procedure would be for this, but in the 90s, do you think they just would have wheeled the coffin right into the like?
Well, that the coffin is on the cargo thing.
Yeah.
And that I think that is how it happens when you're shipping a body. It's also really complicated to ship a body, although they're crossing state lines and not crossing federal lines, but it is really complicated to send a body to another place to be buried. But I don't know, it's if you spend the money, it happens, basically.
Yeah, which obviously, you know, like Julie Andrews' character would have taken care of.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Or he had it arranged before he died because he was a successful architect, so he might have taken care of all of that. I don't know.
I do love that Anne-Margaret, when she's at Julie Andrews' house, sleeps with the wig on. That makes sense. I just think it's funny. It would happen. I believe it, but
I forget. I didn't even notice that. That's so funny.
Because when she does,
why would she sleep with her wig on?
But she never does at home. But then when she's at Juliana's, but she comes out with like the milk and she finds the tape recorder, and it's full wig.
Because you're ruining your wig by doing that.
Yes, yeah. But then she's complimented on it. So I don't know what she's doing, but it's working. Yeah, I most of my notes are just about the goddamn chocolates. That's my overarching theme. Is the gals were great. Hugh Grant, not into it. And why won't you let him eat those goddamn chocolates?
I would also be interested to find out how he even ends up in this movie, because as far as I don't know that he ever lived in California to say that he would be cast in a network TV movie.
I wonder if either
he did. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe he was friends with Julie, or he must have had some kind of connection. But I mean, you know, it was early days.
It's weird to like pull someone from another country in for a network TV movie unless they're already there. Like, that's an expenditure that you're not usually going to get on this kind of film.
I wonder. Yeah. I don't know.
Especially because her son's supposed to be American, so it's not like he needed to get a British guy to do it.
Yeah. I don't know. I wonder who else they could have cast in that role. Who else would I see in that role from that era?
Yeah.
But also, who would do it? You know, that's another question.
Yeah. I mean, that also might be it. That might be it, that they had trouble finding somebody. But I don't know. Especially if you already have two names playing the leads, you don't need a name to play the son. And he's not a name at this point. So it's like, I'm sure that you could still find somebody.
Yeah.
But it could be. I don't know. He he had his breakthrough with Morris in 87. It didn't make him a star, but like he and James Wilby won Best Actor at Venice for that movie. So
yeah.
I'm sure that at some point there was a manager or somebody who said, you know, come live in LA and try your hand at things here. So it could be that that's why he was there. I don't know.
Now I'm just imagining Merchant Ivory's Our Sons, but
I mean, that'd
with
be great.
100% more Tchaikovsky. Lila. Yeah.
It's 2 years after this that he has a small part in The Remains of the Day. And I remember when he showed up in that film, I thought, oh, that's the cute guy from Morris. And then a year later is Four Weddings and a Funeral. And then it's just over, you know, it's just,
off to the races. Yeah.
It's all done at that point. But I don't know. I thought I knew his career well, but maybe someone knows why he's in this film, because it would be interesting. And then, of course, the movie ends with this very moving and devastating title card about the fact that at that point, 108,000 people in America had died of AIDS. You know, we all know all about the devastation of that.
And also, like, that, to be honest, because it's 2024 and growing up in more in the 2000s, I think, oh, the number was that low then, you know what I mean? Like, that's what I thought.
That's a lot of people in 6 years, it's 10 years at this point since it was first documented. That's a lot of people.
It's crazy. And I mean, those are only the documented cases.
Yeah, you know, so. Yeah, that's right. There are a lot of people who officially died of pneumonia or whatever, but yeah.
Yeah.
You can't pick Victor Victoria, Mary Poppins, or The Sound of Music. So what's your favorite Julie Andrews performance?
Oh, that is choosing violence by making me choose another one. How dare you? Oh God. Well, between those three, it's easy, but I guess I'll have to think outside the box. There are a lot of questionable Blake Edwards movies like Darling Lily and That's Life, which, I mean, yeah. Darling Lily is absurd, but
I still haven't seen it. I still haven't seen it.
It's completely whack. She does a strip tease with a bunch of gel colored. It's wild.
That's the one with Rock Hudson?
Yes. Flying a plane and killing the Red Baron. It's very cross genre.
There's a few of her majors her major bombs, that I haven't seen. That one and Star are two of her movies that I haven't seen.
Star's great. Star's not a great movie, but she's great in it.
Yeah.
And it's actually, I would say that's like pretty much perfect casting. Right. Gertrude Lawrence played by Julie Andrews. Like,
you
can't really go better than that. In terms of favorite, I mean, you know, I did, even though I really have not a fun time watching Anne Hathaway and a lot of things these days, I did love The Princess Diaries as a child. And she's so delightful in it. I was waiting for her in this movie to say, you know, a queen is never late. Everyone else is simply early.
I've never seen that movie either.
It's the first one is really, really charming. It's set in San Francisco. It's really funny watching Julie Andrews try and drive a Mustang up the San Francisco hills. From a sentimental perspective, again, because you're not letting me choose those,
it's an opportunity to highlight something that's not the obvious choice, I guess is what I mean. Is that like,
yeah, totally, a, totally, totally, totally. But Star, I remember her being quite good in Star. The top three would obviously be the ones you mentioned. How about you? What's your favorite?
Hawaii. I think she's amazing in Hawaii. Yeah. It's a difficult movie. It has its moments. It's so beautiful. It's kind of boring. There's also different versions floating around because I recently showed it to a friend, but I was like, why is this movie only 3 hours? I remember it being long. Like, there's different versions of it. But I think that she's a real gem in that one. I know her daughter said that that's her favorite of her mom's movies. And I wonder if that's just because she was with her in Hawaii or something.
I mean, it could be like the sentimental attachment.
Because it's not a fully successful film, but it really shows off Julie again as someone who's like, she's the girl with grit, but it's not like cute and feisty. It's actually like a real person that you get behind, you know?
Considering her history really makes sense, but she's not always allowed to show it. So
yeah, and there's no way that movie was that good a time to make. Like, those big budget epics in the 60s were disasters that took forever, and the weather was always ruining shooting days. And she's there between like Richard Harris and Max von Sydow, which means like one's always drunk, the other one's always probably not very funny. It could not have been a great time, but
I think she talks about it being grueling in the book. I recall that vaguely.
Yeah.
It makes sense. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of those that era of Julie Andrews. I don't know. I wish she'd done more work on the stage, to be honest. But
I just wish she had made more movies because she is really great. There's that scene in Hawaii where he had force fed her bananas when they were sailing over while she was like seasick, and then when she gives it back to him, when she's like, "Don't you ever, when I tell you I'm not well and whatever, like, don't you ever force feed food on me?" Like it's so great. Anyway,
well, it's not gonna beat her calling Anne Margaret a stupid bitch. So
no, oh god, classic moment. What's a favorite? What do you think of first when you think of loving Anne Margaret?
I think I think of Bye Bye Birdie because I do love that piece. Mm-hmm. I love the show and I like the movie. I just think it's so much fun. Like yeah. Bye Bye Birdie isn't trying to be anything. It's not. And then I think of her television work because she's someone growing up. Because I used to watch Saturday Night at the Movies and I would watch television late with my parents. She was one of those people who was always just happened to be on something.
Yeah,
you know?
She was so the circus of the stars.
Like young Anne Margaret and then like senior Anne Margaret. But I do think of Streetcar because from everything I've seen of that performance on the TV movie, it's really excellent work. And I wish she'd done more. I think she did a lot of stuff regionally on stage in the States. But or at least a decent amount. But again, I kind of think what are the dream roles that Anne Margaret could have done on stage? Dramatic work and also musicals. You know, she could she could do it. You know, she could have done it all. So too bad. Too bad. But, you know, I don't feel that sorry for her because she has had a great career.
She has. I always think of Carnal Knowledge. I think she's incredible in that film.
Yeah,
I love that performance. And then I don't love the movie of Tommy, but like that's a rare case of someone getting an Oscar nomination for a fully sung role.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Yeah, I'm not a huge Ken Russell person, but
with like two notable exceptions in my mind. But yeah, I'm not either. Yeah,
she's just one of those people who you know is going to deliver, which comes from that kind of showgirl mentality that being in the chorus, being a tough as nails, you know?
Yeah. And also the child of immigrants, you know, like she moved from Sweden when she was a little girl and it was all about like making it in the new country and all that stuff. She took it seriously. Yeah. James, my dear sweet Jimmy, it's always, always, always a pleasure to have you on the show. It's always a pleasure to call you Jimmy because I know you hate it, but you let me get
it. Oh, I hate it so much, but I'll let it happen.
It's so, but it makes you so cute. Thank you. Thank you so much for the generosity you always show in appearing on the show and chatting with me. It's always such a pleasure.
Well, thank you. I'll come on anytime. I love being on your show and I love listening to your show. I listen to it every week.
Thank you. I appreciate it. No, I genuinely appreciate that. Tell our listeners where they can find you, follow you, all that stuff.
I'm on Instagram at James Gibson Bray. If you can't spell my name, just look for the super gay headshot. And that's me. Same on Twitter. You can find me frolicking around the East End of Toronto, listening to sad opera arias and looking distracted. So
amazing. Yeah, try to pick out which one he is from the.
I'm the one carrying on the Met Opera tote bag and over caffeinated. Yeah.
Magnificent. All right. Thank you, love.
So nice to see you, Bill. Thanks so much.
Okay.